We don't have a chair, but obviously I'm very happy to take any questions.
Well, I have a very short question. You spoke about politics around the festivals, but you are also an expert of Polish life after the war. So what would you say about the Warsaw Festival as a similar promoter of avant-garde supported from both sides, probably?
The Warsaw Festival is, I don't know how many of you know the Warsaw Festival, this was in the
60s.
It was started in 58.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But what was remarkable about the Warsaw Festival was that, of course, it became a political statement, and to that extent, what I always found extraordinary about attending it was to see all the people who would normally be going to Beethoven concerts coming to concerts of avant-garde music in their droves and sitting there, and one suspects not always finding it particularly pleasurable, but they were there to make a statement. The Polish government, of course, was on a tightrope, and it had to be extremely careful about how far it could actually go. And I do remember, just before martial law, I remember being at the final reception of one of the Warsaw Autumn Festivals when there was no alcohol. This was like a statement, you know, we haven't been given any money, so we just have juice. And the rumours started to spread around the room, and people did believe it, that the Russians had invaded. And this was a perfectly possible thing to have happened at that time. This was the heyday of Solidarity, when Solidarity had 11 million members in Poland and big hotels taken over. It's quite extraordinary. And, of course, it was quite clear that something had to happen, and what happened was Jaruzelski took over. And at that point, the Warsaw Autumn Festival lost its kind of... And it still happens, of course, but it has acquired a certain kind of middle-age spread.
Technology at Gazan University, and we also read the book, the very short introduction of Bollmann, and we talked on the Eurovision Song Contest. And it was very interesting for us, and we looked at the show and tried to analyze the show, and we have asked us this combination of very diverse elements of style, Oriental, Greek elements and other, and pop elements. Could one interpret that as an attempt to appeal a mass audience for reasons of winning? Strategy?
Well, I think if you get into the question of the actual competition, who wins, then you get into a very murky politics indeed, politics with a small rather than a big P. And this is something that Bowman has actually himself worked on quite a lot. It's what happens backstage that is terribly interesting and not very savoury, in fact, in this respect. As to style, I think, in a way, I was trying to say it. What you are getting is a kind of synthetic conformity. You get a model that is essentially a conformant model, just like 19th century art, national music, a conformant model that is inflected. If you do look back to, I know we talked about this the other day, but if you do consider so-called national schools in the 19th century art music, what do the national elements really consist of? They consist of a handful of rather stereotypical gestures, particular modal types of, open bourdon fifths, certain kinds of ornamentation, etc., which are common to an awful lot of these. They're just like signifiers saying, this is national. And then how you specify the nation is more about reception and about the materials. And I think it's exactly similar. I mean, there are two two things that began to emerge, I think, in the European Song Contest as distinctive signs. One was the kinds of Orientalisms associated with Southeast Europe. The other was actually from closer to here, this kind of, what's her name, Zina the warrior princess, you know, the big drum, associated with the Ukrainian
Ruslan.
Entry.
Yes, Ruslan.
It is Zina, isn't it?
Ruslan.
Ruslan. the name of
Yeah, yes, yes, and that song also for a while became very popular, but you found it, you know, across several different nations. You know, visually it was exciting, you know, the big drums and the young women.
My question was, what do you were impressed with that diplomatic function of music, because that foreign relations and so on, and that all foundation guys, you still...
Not in art music. Not in art music. I mean, that's really the point. At the end, when I said, you know, that politicians were no longer interested, I mean, that was the point. Towards the end of the Cold War, that was already the case. There was no longer a deal in it for politicians, whereas in the early days, given the high seriousness the Soviets attached to classical culture and so on, there really was a deal in it, and that was why the Americans had to respond. I mean, there's this whole series of books that have come out on this. There's a book by Francis Stoller Saunders called Who Pays the Piper, I think, which is a very carefully documented study of the American government state archives. And it is extraordinarily revealing what the CIA was up to in that respect. And then various other books. Amy Bayal looked at particularly at the Americans in West Germany, a book called New Music, New Allies. And then Toby Thacker wrote a book, and also Peter Carroll wrote a book on the Congress of Cultural Freedom and so on. So there's a lot of material around now about this sort of thing. Even Darmstadt. Although I don't think a CIA link has been clearly established there, but nevertheless, it's part of the same story. And there was a couple of years ago, I remember there was a radio program on BBC called Darmstadt and the CIA, which was sort of about that. I mean, I think they concluded you couldn't prove anything, but it was part of the picture. Yeah.
A question on the third part of your paper. You said that Greek musicians nowadays they even have contacts with you said Egyptian musicians also. So is it really? I mean, are there really gatherings involved and cooperation? And if so, I mean, is there a sponsor who pays?
Well, I mean, some of it is self-funding. For example, on Crete. There is, ironically, an Irishman who has been in Crete for quite a long time, called Ross Daly, who has set up a big kind of... It's for teaching Middle Eastern repertories, and it extends to what one might call progressive pop of that orientation. There is a whole movement, Paradosiaka, which is a kind of progressive popular music that wants to reintroduce Middle Eastern instruments and North African, because, you know, the Ottoman tradition is obviously, it's a makam tradition, it's quite closely related to the Arab makam. It's not the same, but it's related to the Arab makam traditions that you find in North Africa as well. Also, there is a sort of, there has been, one of the most interesting things here has been the kind of, what you might call the return to Anatolia of Rebetika. I don't know if everybody knows. Rebetika is usually regarded as a kind of syncretic popular music that came over from... At the time of the exchange of populations in the 1920s, when, as you may know, all the Greek Christians in Anatolia had to exchange with the Turkish Muslims in modern Greece. So there was a massive exchange of populations, extraordinary event. Now at that time, this genre called the Rebetika was formed particularly around Piraeus, you know, near Athens. And of course what's happened now is that that is returned to Anatolia. So you will find Rebetika being performed in the clubs in Turkey, now in Istanbul and so on.
Thank you very much for this very, very nice story about Balkan music. But one thing you didn't mention gypsies.
No.
Roma people, because it's if you think this all this folk pop music, jargon music, turbo folk, and this what is behind this folk is gypsy musicians, and this is very important to remember, because these Roma people, they have no this kind of idea of nationalism. As for instance, Kurdi people in Turkey, they have Kurdistan and so on, but we don't have Gypsyistan in Europe, as I know. And this is very important special feature in this very big area from Ukraine to Greece.
Yeah, I know. You're absolutely right. I didn't mention it. I have a whole section of my book on it, but I didn't mention it today. I mean, what is very interesting there is that I think many of the features that are associated with Roma music making, and as you say, of course, Roma, what the Roma did essentially, they were like bees, you know, they pollinated various places, so they would take idioms from A to B, and then you would get a relationship established between A and B. But if you're looking at it stylistically, I think that actually what the Romas, although they tend to be known for, you know, asymmetrical rhythms and all these kinds of characters, actually what they did in many ways was to simplify the kinds of light classical music that one associated with Ottoman traditions. So as they came into Europe, these kinds of, even the sorts of the asymmetrical rhythms are, if anything, they are simplifications of what were much more complicated rhythmic structures within Ottoman music. And in the same way, they simplified the makam. So that, you know, I have talked to many Roma musicians and asked them what they are doing when they are playing makam sega or whatever it may be. And, you know, what they will say is, well, you just play a D scale and you inflect the F slightly, you know. I mean, it's that basic, whereas if you actually read makam theory, this is a highly complex subject. I mean, there's another big story there about the relation of theory and praxis, even within Ottoman classical music, but still, what the Roma were doing was, in essence, a kind of simplification. And of course, they make no claim to the originality of repertory. And this is, I mean, you see, the thing for the Roma, it was a kind of commercial thing. What you did when you arrived anywhere was to find out what the local styles were, because the local styles would be the things that would sell. Then you learnt it, and then you gave it the Roma touch. So, you know, the originality lies not in repertory, but in performance method, actually. So I think anybody interested in what one might grandly call performance studies and the emancipation of performance within music history should pay a lot of attention to the Roma, I think.
Yes. You're right that this simplification is also concerning with rhythms, and nowadays everything is always shifted.
Yes, exactly.
Always. This is really the model, the only one.
But I mean, within Ottoman theory, And indeed, within Arab systematist theory of the Middle Ages, the rhythmic cycle is at least as close to something like an Indian rag as it is to what we would call a Western meter. You know, you are looking at a cycle here, and it may be quite a short, simple cycle, but it may even be quite a lengthy one. You could get a cycle of 53 beats, for example, within some Ottoman classical. Now, musicians would tend to think of this in a simpler way, usually, by differentiating between what they would call long and short beats. You know, so, you know, 53 can be structured in twos and threes of various in shorts and longs. You know, and that's how they tend to think of it. Absolutely. That's why I kind of differentiated. I know it's a slightly crude term. I differentiate between Balkan and backward, and glamorous and global, because actually American MTV, music TV, was hugely influential, as indeed were some musicals and things in this respect, and some of the American divas were. Greek divas like Anavisio, there's been a Vendi, for example, took a great deal from American popular culture in this respect.
And there's MTV Europe as opposed to Europe.
Yeah, but the American model was there was huge interest in the American model. So, you know, you get the two things playing simultaneously. I mean, you were talking about hip-hop. There was also a whole movement in Greek popular music, you know, to kind of keep up with all these fashions. Though, as I was implying in my question to you yesterday, they tended to take on a slightly different meaning when they got to Greece. But so you have the two things pulling against each other. On the one hand, there is this kind of following the fashions of American pop. On the other hand, there is this kind of resistance being set up in which Orientalism becomes a very useful kind of function, you know. That, and especially if you can, in the way that Weser describes in his article, you can link these Oriental traits to something that is indigenous or Ottoman.